Hello, TWA. It is time for a small lesson in art history. Just ignore the vibrator. And I will read a passage from... what is this book? Let's see here. Oh, balls. Hold on one second. It's The Psychology of Beauty by Puffer House, and it's public domain, which is pretty cool. Let's see. Though it was published very recently, 2003. That's interesting. Anyway. Alright. Let's see here. In what consists the beauty of visual form? The older writers on what we know as the science of art did not ask themselves this question. Although we are accustomed to hear that order, symmetry, unity, and variety was the Greek and particularly the Platonic formula for beauty, we observe on examining the passage cited in evidence that it is rather the moral quality appertaining to these characteristics that determines them as beautiful. Symmetry is beautiful because harmonious and inducing order and self-restraint. Aristotle's single pronouncement in the sense of our question is the dictum, there is no beauty without a certain magnitude. Lessing, in his Laocoon, really the first modern treatise in aesthetics, discusses the excellence of painting and poetry, but deals with the visible beauty as if it were a fixed quality, understood when referred to like color. This undoubtedly due to his unconscious reference of beauty to the human form alone, a reference which he would have denied, but which influences his whole aesthetic theory. In speaking of a beautiful picture, for instance, he would have meant, first of all, the representation of a beautiful persons in it. Hardly at all that essential beauty of the picture as a painting, to which every inch of the canvas is alike precious. It is clear to us now, however, that the beauty of the human form is the most obscure of all possible cases, complex in itself, and overlaid and involved as it is with innumerable interests and motives of extra aesthetic character. Beauty in simple forms must be our first study. And great credit due to Hogarth for having propounded in his analysis of beauty the simple question, what makes the quality of beauty to the eye? But in visible beauty, the aesthetic value of pure form is not the only element involved. It must be settled whether or not it is the only element involved. If, in a work of art, as we believe, what belongs to its excellence belongs to its beauty, we may not applaud the painter, for instance, for his marvelous color schemes, another for his expression of emotion, another for his delineation of character, without acknowledgement that expression of character and emotion come within our concept of visual beauty. Franz von Lenbach was once asked, what he thought likely to be the fate of his own work. As for that, he replied, I think I may possibly have a chance of living, but only for individualization of characterization to be deemed to constitute a quality of permanent value in a picture. This, however, I shall never know, for it can only be adjudged by posterity. If that verdict should prove unfavorable, then my work, too, will perish with the rest, for it cannot compare on their lines with great masters of the past. That is indeed the issue. That is indeed an issue shown by the constraining opinions of the critic who exclaimed before a portrait, think away the head and face, and you will have a wonderful effect of color. The analysis of visible beauty accordingly resolves itself into the explanation of the beauty of form, including shape and color, and fixing in relation thereto of other factors. The most difficult part of our task is indeed behind us. We have already defined beauty in general. We have outlined in a preceding essay the abstract aesthetic demands. And we have now only to ask what psychological means these demands can be and are in fact met. In other words, we have to show that we have to show that what we intensely feel as beauty can and does exemplify these principles. Through them is explained and accounted for. Beauty has been defined as that combination of qualities and an object which brings about a union of stimulation and repose in the enjoyer. How must this be interpretive with reference to these particular facts of visual form? The most immediate reference is naturally to the sense organ itself. The first question is as therefore as to the favorable stimulations of the eye. What in general does the eye demand of its object? The simplest element of the visual experience is of course found in light and color, the sensation of the eye as such. Yet there is no branch of aesthetic which is so incomplete. We know that the sensation of light and color, if not too weak or too violent, is in itself pleasing. The bright, glittering, shiny object, so long as it's not painful, is pleasantly stimulating. Gems, tinsel, lacquer, polish, testify to this taste. From the most primitive to the most civilized man, color too, if distinct, not over bright nor too much extended in its field, is in itself pleasing. The single colors have been the object of comparatively little study. Experiment seems to show that colors containing the most brightness, white, red, and yellow, are preferred. Baldwin, in his dynamogenic experiments, based on the view that an infant's hands, movement, and reaching and grasping are the best indexed of the kind of intensity of its sensory experiences, finds that color range themselves in order of attractiveness: blue, white, red, green, brown. Further corrections lay more emphasis upon the white. Yellow was not preferences of 7 or 8 different sets of students at Radcliffe and Wellesley colleges. Experience of this kind are particularly difficult, inasmuch as the material, usually colored paper, varies considerably from the spectral color differences in saturation, hue, brightness, make great differences in the results. While the feeling, tone of association, individual or racial, very often intrudes, but other things being equal, the bright, clear, saturated color is relatively more pleasing, and white, red, and yellow seem especially preferred. Now, according to the Herrian theory of color, white, red, and yellow are the so-called dissimulating colors in the three pairs, white, black, red, green, and yellow, blue, corresponding to their hypothetical visual substances in the retina. These substances, that is, undergoing a kind of chemical disintegration under the action of light rays, are supposed to give the sensations white, red, or yellow respectively in renewing themselves again, to give the sensations of black, green, and blue. This dissimulating process seems to bring about stronger reactions on the physiological side, as if it were a more exciting process. Thus, it is found that, as measured by the increase of strength of hand grip under stimulation of respective color, red has a particularly inciting qualities, but the other colors have an analogous effect, lessening, however, with the descent from red to violet. The pleasure in bright red or yellow, for instance, may thus be, well, the feeling and tone arising purely physiological effect of color. If red works like a trumpet call, while blue calms and cools. And if red is preferred to blue, it's because a sharp stimulation is so felt and so preferred. While all this may be true, however, the most important question has not been asked. Is truth of color representative in art the same thing as beauty of color? It might be said that the whole procedure of the so-called Impressionist school, in fact, the whole trend of modern treatment of color, took their identity for granted. Yet, we must discriminate. Truth of color may be truth of the local color of given objects alone, or together. In this case, we should have to say that beauty did or did not exist in the picture according as it did exist in the original combination. A red hat on a purple chair would set one's teeth on edge in a model or picture. Secondly, the truth of color may be the truth to the modifications of enveloping light, and in this case, truth would make for beauty. For colors of any given scene, or in general not colors, which the objects themselves, if isolated, would have, but the colors which the eye itself is forced to see. The bluish shadow of an object in bright sunlight, yellowish light, is only expression of the law that in the neighborhood of a Blue. I think I skipped a line. Is really supplied in the picture. It is not only true, but on the road to beauty, because meeting the eye's demand. The older method of painting gave the local color of an object with an admixture of white for the light and a warm dark for the shadow. The modern, which had been touched on, indeed sporadically, gives in shadow the complementary color of an object combined with the light falling upon it, all conditions of favorable stimulation. Further favorable stimulation of the eye, given in the methods of impressionists treating the values, that is, comparative relations of light and shade, the real tone of objects inducing the sky light could never be reproduced. The older schools, conscious of this, were satisfied to paint in a scale of correspondence, which the relative values were fairly kept. But even by that means, great differences of intensity could not be reproduced. The older schools, conscious of this, were satisfied to paint in a scale of correspondence, in which the relative values were fairly kept. Maybe I should skip ahead. Let's see. But we ought to note on the borderland. Ooh. But we ought to note a borderland in which concern is professed not with beauty, but with ideas of life. Aristotle's lover of knowledge, who rejoiced to say of a picture, this is that man, is the inspirer of drawing, as opposed to the art of visual form. It is not beauty we seek from Rembrandt. Of the etching and woodcuts from Hogarth, Goya, where there is a conflict, beauty, as we defined it, goes to the wall. We may trace, perhaps, the ground of this highly increased amount of symbolic associative power given and required in the black and white, even to understand such a picture demand an enormous amount of unconscious mental sublimation that is natural to find the aesthetic center of gravity. It's aesthetic center of gravity in that element. The first conditions of the work, that is to determine trend and aim. The part played by imagination in our vision of an etching must be so important. That is, after all, the imaginative part which outweighs the given. Nor do we desire given to infringe upon the ideal field. Thus we do not understand that for most drawings, the background vague and formless. Ugh. Ugh. Okay. Where was I? Blah blah blah. Goya. What? In what consists the beauty of visual form? If this question could be answered in a sentence, our whole discussion of the abstract formula for beauty would have been unnecessary. But since we know that the elements of visual form must do to bring about the ecstatic experience, it has been the aim of the preceding pages to show how those elements must be determined and related. The eye, the psychophysical organism, must be favorably stimulated. These and such colors, combinations, lines, as we have described, are fitted to do it. It must be brought to a response, these and such relations between lines and colors, as we have set forth, are fitted to do it for reasons we have given. It is to the eye all that waits upon the first and last appeal. A fine art must be made, and insofar the emotion or idea belonging to a picture which waits upon which waits upon the eye, insofar does it enter into the characteristic excellence that is the beauty of visual form. Oh my god. The experimental treatment of the isolated elements detected in the particular function of each in distributing attention in the field of view. It doesn't even make sense anymore. But while all are possibly operative and given in the picture, some are given, as we see, much more important than others. In particular picture types, different elements are predominant. In each... Oh my god. Where was that predominant? In those classes, a general symmetrical framework, such as the altar and Madonna pieces, are elements of interest and direction. Attention determine the balance, for they appear as variations of symmetry, which has already, so to speak, disposed of mass and line. They give what action there is, and where they very strongly, where they are very strongly operative, they're opposed by salient lines and deep vistas, which act more strongly on the attention than does the mass. Interest, keeps its predominance throughout the types except in the portraits where the head is usually the central line. But even among the portraits, it has a respectable representation as jewels, embroideries, beautiful hands, etc. Count largely to composition. The direction of attention is most operative among the portraits. Since these pictures represent no action, they must be given by the elements which move and distribute the attention in concordance. In accordance with which principle, we find the line is also unusually influential. As remarked above, altarpieces and Madonna pictures are also largely without action, depending largely for it on the direction of attention. The vista, as said above, rivets and confines the attention. We can therefore understand how it is that generic pictures it appears very numerous. The active character of these pictures naturally requires to be modified, and the vista introduces a powerful balancing element, which is yet quiet, or it might be said in so much as energy. Certainly expanded in plunging down the third dimension. In the vista introduces an element of action counterbalancing character. In the landscape, it introduces the principal element of variety. It is always to be found in these parts of the picture which are opposed to other powerful elements, heavier on the other side. The deeper the vista. Also in pictures with the two groups, it serves as a kind of fulcrum or unifying element in so much as it rivets the attention between the two detached sides. The direction of suggestion by means of indication of a line, quite naturally more frequent in the Madonna picture. Both these types are large, simple outline that would be expected to tell. In a decided majority of cases, combined with the vista, the shape being more or less diagonal, a diagonal slope, is clear that it acts as a kind of bond between the two sides, carrying the attention without a break from one or the other. The element mass requires less comment. It appears in the greatest number of pictures which have little action. Portraits and landscapes which are not yet symmetrical. The last case of mass is, of course, already balanced. In fact, it must be of necessity to exert certain influence in every unsymmetrical picture, so its percentage, even for genre pictures, is large. Thus we may regard the elements both attracting attention and dispersing it over a field. What? Those types of which static character landscapes, altarpieces abound in elements which disperse the attention, which are of a dynamic character, and those make it stable. The ideal composition seems to combine the dynamic and static elements to animate, in short, the view of a bilateral fashion. Elements, substitutional symmetry, are then simply means for introducing variety in action as a dance in which, something beautiful, the particular functions. The particular function of the elements which are substituted for geometrical symmetry have been made clear. Their presence lends to a variety of richness that the balance of motor impulses. Richness to the balance of motor impulses. Fuck. Okay, skip ahead. The beauty of music. What the fuck? Oh, fuck it. I guess that's good enough. Ugh.